Gregory Moore against Paul Barnett. Mr. Ryan?
May it please the court, Marty Ryan, counsel for Greg Moore. In this case, Mr. Moore was given incorrect advice by his appointed counsel. More specifically, his appointed counsel didn't know which Illinois sentencing good conduct law applied to his client, the result of which was he gave his client a greatly exaggerated viewpoint on the sentencing consequences of going to trial. Since the time of Mr. Moore's guilty plea, he has complained about counsel's incorrect advice to state courts on several occasions, and while without having any success, no court has concluded that the advice given by counsel was correct. Despite Mr. Moore's persistence in raising this claim over and over in state court, the state nonetheless asserts that this claim is defaulted. Even though the state has had several chances to address this claim, and comedy principles I don't think would be served by saying that the state court has really not had a chance to address this. To preclude on the issue of default, which is of course the issue that the district court decided this case on, to preclude federal habeas review, state court decision has to clearly rest on an independent and adequate state ground. If the basis is ambiguous or unclear, then under the plain statement rule, federal review is allowed. And this case, I believe, is unique in that we have two decisions by the highest state court on this case. In the direct appeal, the court addressed the merits of the ineffective assistance and did also reach a waiver conclusion. On the post-conviction appeal, the court indicated, discussed when a similar issue was raised, albeit with an additional fact on post-conviction, the same appellate court judge indicated that the direct appeal finding actually rested on the merits. And here are some of the quotes from the post-conviction opinion. The court wrote that its findings with respect to the guilty plea admonishments and Moore's lack of hesitancy about being admonished and taking the plea were, quote, conclusions essential to our decision on direct appeal, unquote. The court also wrote that because Mr. Moore had a chance to make a record at the hearing on the motion to withdraw a plea, quote, defendant properly presented his ineffective assistance of counsel claim on direct appeal, unquote. The court also wrote that it, quote, considered at length defendant's claim that Keel's ineffective assistance resulted in defendant's involuntary guilty plea, unquote. And lastly, the court based its claim on res judicata, which means that they thought that they had decided it already, rather than saying you're re-raising a claim that's waived. Being the words of the last state court to actually render a decision in this case, given that the Illinois Supreme Court turned down review in this case twice, the words of the last state court to address the issue show that it primarily rested its decision on direct appeal on the merits and not waiver. And the state has not addressed the fact that they addressed the issue on direct appeal or any of the discussions in the post-conviction decision. And I think at most you could say that these were interwoven, the waiver and the merits holding on direct appeal. But even under that scenario, federal review is allowed.
Of course, you're not asking us to review the reasonableness of the state court's procedural ruling.
No. And this, I do believe in the brief that I mentioned that the waiver finding was unreasonable, but I don't even think it's necessary to reach that. I believe the basis essentially that, in a nutshell, the district court erred in finding the default under the plain, under the independent and adequate state grounds rule, and we request writ of habeas corpus. If there are any questions, any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ryan. We'll hear now from Ms. O'Connell.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Margaret O'Connell. I'm an assistant attorney general. I represent the respondent in Indiana. It is the respondent's position that the district court properly found independent and adequate state law grounds precluded a merit review of petitioner's claim. In doing so, the district court properly relied upon Coleman versus Thompson and Harris versus Reed. In Coleman versus Thompson, the United States Supreme Court has told us that when a state court declines to address a petitioner's federal claim due to the petitioner's failure to meet a state procedural requirement, that state judgment is in fact independent and adequate state grounds which preclude federal habeas review.
The state court certainly didn't decline to decide this federal issue, though, did they?
Well,
there were several instances where they seemed to be deciding it, I thought.
Well, there are several. I would certainly agree that there are several instances where the appellate court, both in the direct appeal and also in the post-conviction appeal, discussed the merits of petitioner's underlying claim. It is the position of the respondent that merits analysis is in fact done in an alternative manner. And we rest our decision on that, our argument on that, on Harris versus Reed and this court's most recent decision in Brooks versus Wall. It is the position of the respondent that Harris versus Reed tells us that when you have two occurrences in an appellate court opinion, one being procedural and the other being a lack of merit determination, if by reading that opinion it is clear that the state court did in fact rest its decision primarily upon a state procedural ground.
How about the post-conviction court here? Was that an alternative holding?
As to the merits the discussion of the merits. Well, there are a couple of things to be pointed out as far as the post-conviction appellate court's review of or discussion of the lack of merit in petitioner's claim. I do believe that that is an alternative ruling, to answer your question directly, Your Honor, and that their reliance upon res judicata is clear. I think that the trial court, in denying the post-conviction petition, clearly told the petitioner, because of the way that he framed the issue in his post-conviction petition,
which was... Do you think res judicata is an independent state ground here? Or it's res judicata, I gather, as to the federal claim, isn't it?
Well,
the
usage of the term res judicata here is confusing in light of this court's decision in Gomez versus Acevedo. I am not standing here saying that I'm not relying upon the post-conviction appellate court's decision on determining res judicata. I believe that the controlling procedural default here was the direct appeal court's finding of waiver. I further believe that the post-conviction court, in using the term res judicata, was referring to the fact that what the petitioner wanted was the post-conviction court to reconsider the Illinois appellate court's decision finding waiver.
I'm finding that very difficult, and I have to tell you why. Because on collateral review, the state courts treated the direct appeal court's decision as primarily resting not on waiver, in my view, but on the merits of his ineffective assistance claim. So the claim can be argued on federal habeas review.
I disagree with that position. I believe that when they use the term res judicata, that they are saying to the petitioner, res judicata as far as the fact that waiver has previously been found on this claim. Not res judicata as used in Gomez versus Acevedo, where there is an actual merits determination. So I think the use of the term is confusing, but the rationale for the term...
Well, if I can quote from the post-conviction court, when it affirmed the denial of Moore's petition on the ground of res judicata, it stated that on direct appeal, it, quote, considered at length defendant's claim that Kuehl's ineffectiveness resulted in defendant's involuntary guilty plea. So it was reiterating its reason for rejecting his claim on direct appeal, and it also said that those conclusions were essential to our decision on direct appeal. So
regarding the finding of waiver. If you go back to the direct appeal decision and looking at the language that was used by the district court, it's clear that ruling was, in fact, done in the alternative. The appellate court stated, and I'm quoting from the district court's opinion, that even if the defendant had not waived this argument, we would conclude that he failed to demonstrate ineffective assistance of counsel.
Well, I just can't see how any court could say he waived. So
how he waived?
I have a real problem here.
And I'm just further inquiry as to how it is that he waived the claim of ineffective assistance due to the alleged giving of wrong advice. Well, the finding of waiver was premised on the idea that at the time that the defendant pled guilty, he had Mr. Chule as his attorney. He's then given new counsel, and new counsel drafts a written motion to withdraw his previously entered plea of guilty. Within that written motion, counsel does in fact present in writing this argument that Mr. Chule gave incorrect legal advice regarding the amount of good conduct credits the petitioner would have earned while in the Department of Corrections. But at the hearing on the motion to withdraw the plea of guilty, those facts were never developed through the testimony of either the petitioner or Mr. Kuehl, nor was that an argument that post-plea counsel relied upon in the hearing on the motion to withdraw the plea of guilty. It is for that reason that the Illinois Appellate Court found waiver. He brought the claim, he just never developed it, and he clearly had the opportunity to develop that claim.
Even the trial court acknowledged Mr. Moore's allegations regarding Kuehl's advice and its oral ruling.
I have a copy of the ruling, and the reasons in the conclusion do not go to the claim that there was incorrect advice given about the amount of time the petitioner would have to spend in custody. The conclusions of the trial court after the hearing on the motion to withdraw the plea of guilty go to the other allegations, which were that he was confused, that he had been threatened, and that possibly members of his family had been threatened. But the record in and of itself is silent. Furthermore, a closer review of the record shows that at the time petitioner pled guilty, there's no confusion as to his plea of guilty. There's nothing shown there regarding any hesitation or confusion in his decision to plead guilty.
Well, but he's pleading guilty on foolish, to say the very least, advice. So, I mean, the fact that there's no hesitation, you're not arguing that, are you?
Well, number one, there's nothing in this record to substantiate his claim. Clearly, at the post-conviction proceedings, he could have had an affidavit by Attorney Kuehl attached to his post-conviction petition. He does not have such an affidavit, nor is there any testimony from Mr. Kuehl wherein there's an admission that this actually did occur.
Mr. Kuehl testified about the sentencing issue, did he not?
He did not, Your Honor. He did not testify that he, in fact, gave this advice to petitioner, and that is why the Illinois Appellate Court found waiver, because the record is silent as to a substantiation of his claim. It is for those reasons and the reasons stated in our brief that we ask that this court affirm the district court's denial of the petition for writ of habeas corpus. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. O'Connell. Mr. Ryan?
Your Honors, I'd like to begin by noting that the state actually has waived, in my view, any claim on the merits because it refused to address them in its brief, and now it apparently is taking a position on the merits for the first time in federal court.
Well, hasn't our practice been, if we were to agree with you on the merit on the procedural issue, to remand this to the district court and have the district court take the first shot at the merits?
In all candor, Your Honor, because this is my first time here, I'm not actually certain what the standard operating procedure is. Certainly, this court has the option of addressing the merits if you so choose. On the other hand, you certainly also have the option of sending it back to Judge McCuskey so that he can review it.
Well, if we would decide the case on the merits at this stage, we'd only have the view of one party, wouldn't we, in writing?
Yes. In this case, I would like to respond to some of the things that counsel said. Mr. Kuehl clearly testified, quote, "At the time I was discussing the offer with Greg, it wasn't clear whether that law was going to be retroactive, whether legally it could be retroactive. I had some concerns about it. So in discussing the plea with Greg, that issue came up. I didn't have the statute in front of me. It hadn't become law yet. So for a while, this was an issue, whether he'd have to spend 85% of 20 years, 100% of 20 years, 50% of 20 years. And then we spent a long time discussing that aspect of it.
And that's his testimony.
Yeah.
It's not yet.
It's right there on the record. It's in my brief. I don't know why, as counsel suggests, that Mr. Keel would need an that Mr. Moore would need an affidavit from Mr. Keel, essentially apparently admitting his own ineffectiveness or something. Concerning some of the other things counsel had said, I think, again, clearly when reviewing the post-conviction appeal document, it's written by the same judge, and if we are trying to discern what that judge was doing when he said, I reject the merits and it's waived, I think this is to be blunt, like almost the equivalent of great legislative history on this, is this is what the judge meant. Clearly, resting his conclusions, these conclusions were essential to our decision on direct appeal, and he's referring to merits discussion. He's not referring to waiver. There's no reference to any of that in the post-conviction. As for the additional authority case cited by the state, Brooks v. Wall, my understanding is that that case deals more with whether or not something is properly filed. It's a proper filing case, which is not an issue that's touched on in this case. And the language discussing Harris versus Reed in there doesn't have a factual setup that's similar to this, where you have basically two opinions from a court, and one is very explicit that basically we base this decision on the merits on direct appeal. I think is the easy and fair reading of the post-conviction appeal. If there are no further questions, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Ryan. Mr. Ryan, you served by appointment of this court in this case, and you have the deep thanks of the court for having taken the assignment and done such a fine job for your client. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.